Four States Live. I'm Kevin Seidenstricker along with Shannon Bruffett, and we are the voice of your Four States community. You can check us out on KKOWAM.com. All of our previous recordings are there. If there's anything you missed, check us out there. Also, keep an eye on our Facebook page, Four States Live, and you can get all of our information and contact information there. Reach out to us, message us, let us know if there's something we're saying you don't like, or if there's something you want to hear, and we're going to talk about it. One of the things I really love about doing this show is that we strive so hard to have subject matter experts on here who are well-degreed, possibly published, peer-reviewed, and that's why I love having professors here in the office. That's why I love having professors in the studio with us. So we know that we are getting the straight and skinny from well-degreed and educated people, such as Dr. Darren Sampson from Pitt State University. Dr. Sampson, good morning. How you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Doing really well. Glad to have you here today. And would you please, for our listeners, just describe your background a little bit? It's important that everybody understand the level of education and experience that our experts have.
Sure. Well, I grew up not all that far from here. I grew up near Jefferson City and went to college at Benedictine College, Atchison, Kansas.
Okay.
4 years getting my bachelor's in political science there. And then I received my master's at the University of Arizona and my PhD from Rutgers University.
Wow.
Graduated from Rutgers in 2008 and have been teaching at Pittsburgh State since that time.
Outstanding. And what's your official title there?
Professor of Political Science.
Cool. Now, I understand there's two or three different areas of study that you speak on at Pitt State University.
I have three areas of teaching and expertise at Pittsburgh State. I teach primarily in the areas of judicial and regulatory politics. So I handle the judiciary and I handle bureaucracy. Within bureaucracy, I also deal with environmental politics. That's kind of my main area of interest. And I also have background both in graduate school and in teaching in political philosophy.
Well, then, Doc, I'd say you are very well suited to talk to us about a lot of the legal activity, especially with the Supreme Court that's happened in the last 7 to 10 days. They most recently overturned Roe v. Wade as they were considering the case of Dobbs versus Jackson. That was kind of the initiation of that, if I'm not mistaken. And then just a couple of days ago, they ruled in favor of the coach from the high school in Bremerton, Washington, who after the last two or three games that he was employed there would go to the center of the field, the 50-yard line, and pray. But since Roe v. Wade and the legalization of abortion, I mean, that's been the law of the land for, well, since 1973. I mean, that's a long time. Are there any laws you're aware of like that that stood for so long and then were turned over?
I would say there are a few examples of that. The most obvious example would be the separate but equal doctrine that was established in 1896 by Plessy v. Ferguson, which authorized the states to segregate people by the races.
Oh.
And that was struck down in 1954, famously by Brown v. Board of Education.
Mm-hmm.
So it is not unheard of for the court to go back against its doctrine. And that has been a long conversation on the court. When do we change our minds? When do we change things? And the whole idea of changing precedent in and of itself isn't a bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
The court recognizes, though, that when we do change precedent, we're changing the lives of a lot of people. We're changing the expectations that they have and the expectations that they can have about how they're going to be living their lives. Whether that's for the better or the worse, that is what we debate mm-hmm. as a public. But the amount of precedent changing, the amount of doctrine mm-hmm. that has been changed in the last few days, that is unprecedented.
And my understanding in the legal field, especially with the Supreme Court, is that those precedents are so important that so many follow-on decisions are based on previous precedent that was set. And now, you know, these are standing laws that we've grown up with over the years. And then they get changed all of a sudden, especially when it's something that's so personal to so many people.
Well, I think that there are a couple of things worth noting about the recent changes is that you think back to discussions of segregation and how that was deemed constitutional and then unconstitutional. Mm-hmm. That had a major effect on people's lives, but not to the degree of how personal an issue can be. Here you have the combination of the loss of a 50-year precedent on something as personal and as emotional mm-hmm. as the issues of abortion, childbirth, family planning. All of these issues are really incredibly personal.
Definitely. And I didn't want to go too far down the rabbit hole, but I kind of took us there in Roe v. Wade and it being turned over recently. I'd like for our listeners to understand how the Supreme Court actually began. What was it that put it in place constitutionally? What's been its role over the years?
Sure. To understand the place of the court in our Constitution, and when I say the court, I mean the Supreme Court, mm-hmm. You have to actually go back prior to the Constitution. That is the Constitution that we had as a nation before this Constitution.
Okay.
We went from the Revolutionary War not to our Constitution but into the Articles of Confederation. This was an agreement between 13 pre-existing states that were originally colonies. Mm-hmm. They were all under the crown, but they had their own governments. They had their own legal practices. And the Articles of Confederation bound them together loosely. The government of the United States really only handled very few matters, primarily limited to issues of defense and international relations. One thing the Articles of Confederation did not have was a court. And this led to a lot of problems. If you're going to be binding 13 states together, that means that they're going to have to get along. And if you don't have a court that can sit over them, when it comes to deciding matters of law that involve multiple states, there was no institution you could turn to mm-hmm. And get the impression that this is going to be an overriding and neutral arbiter of the law. Mm-hmm. And so when you're reading the Constitution and the Articles of Confederation failed for a number of reasons, and that is what brought about the desire to create a new Constitution. And when you're reading through the Constitution, I always tell my students, if you find something in the Constitution, there's a great likelihood that it's there because the writers of the Constitution were trying to address a specific problem in the Articles of Confederation. Mm-hmm. And this is how we have to see the court. The creation of the Supreme Court under the Constitution was to address that lack of a judicial authority that could extend over all the states.
I would imagine before that perhaps the arbiter of conflicts or disagreements among the states might have been the office of the President of the United States, right?
No. No? No. The President of the United States under the Articles of Confederation was an incredibly weak power.
Intentionally, right?
Yes. That's because the President of the United States under the Articles of Confederation was really just the President of Congress.
Okay.
It didn't have any real power other than just organizing Congress and finding ways for its limited laws to be implemented. The vast majority of power was held by states. Governors held much more power than the President of the United States because the states were doing so much compared to the federal government. The Constitution creates a new nation and creates institutions that have more power to address the problems that were being seen under the Articles of Confederation.
And so does the Supreme Court then in the very beginning – or was the Supreme Court in the very beginning more or less established to make sure that one branch, either the executive or legislative, didn't have more power than the other?
No, that's a development that happens once the court is created.
Okay.
If you look at the Constitution and you see the various parts of the federal government being created, go to Congress, for example. Congress is created in Article 1. Of the Constitution. Article 1 is quite lengthy. There's a lot of detail about what it is Congress can do, what Congress can't do. Article 2 deals with the presidency. And there's, again, a significant amount of detail about what it is this office can do.
Okay.
When it comes to Article 3, where the Supreme Court is set up, there is very little information there. All Article 3 does is basically set up a Supreme Court, gives Congress the authority to establish what are called inferior courts, courts below. So we think of circuit courts and district courts. Those are created by Congress, not the Constitution, although Congress is given the power to do so directly by the Constitution.
Okay.
So beyond just setting it up and defining a few very specific things the court can do, the Constitution is very silent on what this court should be doing. And a lot of that is because we come from a common law system. The movement from colonies of England to an independent nation involved a number of changes, but a lot of things didn't need to be changed. How contracts were read, how divorces were handled, how inheritance was set. These are the things that courts just do and have been doing for a long time. And because we've come from a common law system and the codes of law aren't written down, they're just part of legal tradition, you can almost imagine the framers saying it's important that we create a court, and we all know what courts do, and those court will do those things. So really the Constitution is just focused on creating a court, not in defining what it can do.
Okay. Well, we need to take a quick break, but when we come back, I'd like to talk about some of the changes that have been made as far as, or considered anyhow, as far as lifetime tenure. You spoke before we started about secrecy and isolation, things that are in place with the court. And we definitely want to talk about court packing, because I think you were telling me earlier, it's not just in the last couple of years this has been discussed. So we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back. I'm Kevin Seidenstricker, along with Dr. Sampson from Pitt State University on Four States Live.
You're listening to Four States Live with Shannon Bruffett and Kevin Seidenstricker, AM 860 and 97.5 KKOW.
Welcome back to Four States Live. I'm Kevin Seidenstricker, along with Dr. Sampson from Pitt State University. He is a professor in political science and political philosophy, and we're discussing the Supreme Court of the United States, its role as defined by the Constitution, and some of its many big decisions. And with those decisions, the roles that these justices play, how are the justices defined?
The Constitution sets up tenure for Supreme Court justices as, in the words of the Constitution, during good behavior. So that basically means lifetime tenure. Unless a judge is impeached or dies or retires, that judge remains on the Supreme Court, not just the Supreme Court, but any other federal court that is established under the authority of the Constitution.
Okay. And other than when someone illegally leaks a draft opinion or document from the Supreme Court, don't they normally operate kind of discreetly? I mean, you never really hear about anything they're talking about until the big decisions come out.
Generally, yes. Again, since the Constitution doesn't specify much about how the court operates, the court gets to make that decision. And the court has decided for centuries to operate in a way that much of D.C. does not operate. D.C. operates in a fishbowl. Everything happens sort of in public view. The court is the opposite. The court operates in isolation, in secrecy. And to understand why, you really have to go back to how the court has evolved into the institution that it is. In the first few years of the court under, say, the Washington and John Adams administrations, the court did not really do much. It just sort of handled the cases that would come to it, answer the questions that needed to be answered, but it wasn't taking any big stands. It wasn't engaged in the other operations of government. And this begins to change in 1803 with Marbury v. Madison. And this is when John Marshall, who really the first Supreme Court justice who really has a vision for what the court could be in relationship to the judicial, in relationship to the legislative and executive branches, in what is really kind of a boring question of law in dealing with whether or not a Secretary of State is authorized to not give a commission to a judge that was appointed and confirmed under the previous administration, John Marshall looks to the law that was the basis of the reason why Marbury came straight to the Supreme Court and determined that the law that sent him there was not consistent with the rules set up in the Constitution. And said basically, this is a tough question to answer, but we're not the ones to answer it. You're in the wrong court. But in so doing, looked at that law that Congress had passed and said that law is inconsistent with the Constitution, and therefore that law is null and void. Okay. This is the power of judicial review. And this is the power that the court significantly uses to intervene in the checks and balances system, to tell in particular Congress or the states, what you're doing is inconsistent with the Constitution. Your authority to act is based on the Constitution. Therefore, if you do something inconsistent with the Constitution, you're doing something you're not allowed to do. Therefore, what you did never really happened or should not have happened. And therefore, that law or policy is null and void.
Okay.
Now, this has been a controversial issue since it first was instituted, because what you have here is nine unelected judges who have lifetime tenure striking down the opinions of state legislatures or Congress, people who were elected and do face re-election. But Marshall's reasoning as to why judicial review is important for the checks and balances system is, I think, definitely worth considering. He sees this as fundamentally a protection of the rights of minorities. And by minor, I mean just any numeric minority, anybody who finds themselves in the minority opposed to a policy, protecting their rights and putting in place limits on the parts of government that should be limited based on the Constitution. If you had judges who were facing elections, they might decide, well, I have to make this decision in a popular way.
Yes.
And so I always tell my students to imagine you're accused of a crime that you did not commit. And it's a heinous crime. And as you're being led to the courtroom, there's mobs of people screaming for your head, screaming for punishment.
Right.
Now, do you want to go before a judge who says, yeah, this person is obviously innocent, but if I find them not guilty, it's going to be very unpopular and I face elections.
Right.
Or
then guess who's not getting elected again?
Exactly. Or I have to do what is right according to the law and I won't be punished for doing that. So this is the philosophy behind judicial review. And we're really seeing it being debated in the public over current issues. In response to the Dobbs v. Jackson decision that ruled that overruled Roe v. Wade, in response to that, a number of people have pointed out that the vast majority of Americans support access to abortion. If you are opposed to abortion, that is an irrelevant point for you. You argue that this has nothing to do with whether it is popular or not. It's whether it is within the bounds of the Constitution.
Exactly.
This is the same argument that could have been made back in 2015 when same-sex marriage was deemed to be constitutionally protected. Although that has changed over time, when the debate of same-sex marriage first came about, there was massive opposition to same-sex marriage, and the supporters of it said that's irrelevant. It's a question of rights. Yes. And that's why we give these judges a lifetime tenure, to protect them from the very democratic influence that shapes and motivates state legislatures and Congress. And it's also why they operate in secrecy. They don't want their – well, there's a couple reasons why they operate in secrecy. One, because legal arguments are usually very dull, and the public just honestly doesn't want to really hear these arguments because they are incredibly dry. But the other reason – and Antonin Scalia espoused this most clearly. He said if we are televised in the way that other political actions are televised, we're going to be playing to the crowd, not to the law.
Right.
And it was Ruth Bader Ginsburg who found the humor in that, said if anybody is going to play to the law, play to the crowd, it would be Antonin Scalia. Scalia and Ginsburg were great friends.
I'd heard that.
Despite having completely different political ideologies. Mm-hmm. And she said it because he was funny. And he was a bit of a ham.
And I think it's a shame we lost her. She had a brilliant mind. She was respected from both sides of the aisle. And she was just one of three Supreme Court justices who left the bench during one president's term in office. So he gets to appoint a whopping three new justices to the court. Naturally, the opposing party is not happy with this. So they talk about court packing. What exactly is that, Doc?
Okay, well, court packing is the idea of we can change the composition of the court. And it's generally called court packing when it is done with the intention of changing the decisions made by the court. The Constitution does not specify there should be nine justices. This is something determined by Congress. And Congress has changed the number of judges over time. If you find yourself as, say, a president facing a Supreme Court that is striking down the policies that you think are necessary, there is incentive to change the composition of the court. Now, this is a risky move. The court is designed to be apolitical. It's designed to apply the law, not to respond to the same sort of political pressures that Congress and state legislatures respond to. But at the same time, the ability of the court to do this is based on the public's faith in the court. Do they see it as a fair institution? And if that faith is being eroded, it can be eroded by packing the court, but it can also be eroded by outside factors. You mentioned that Trump had an unprecedented level of appointments to the court. Other presidents have had three appointments, but over 8-year terms.
Okay. Yeah, and that is an important point to make. I'm glad you mentioned that it was just in that short 4-year period that he had three.
He had three appointments, all of which were for different reasons, controversial. You remember when Antonin Scalia died in 2016, this was 9 months prior to the next election, and Mitch McConnell famously said, we need to let the voters decide before we appoint someone. And then Ruth Bader Ginsburg dies in 2020, 2 months before the next election, and Amy Coney Barrett is rushed through. So there are a lot of controversies surrounding this. And so there has been a lot of erosion of the public's faith of the Supreme Court. But when this affects the Supreme Court, which determines not whether policy is good or bad, but whether policy can even be done, that's when we really run into potentially a constitutional crisis. And this is not new.
And I know there's been a lot of decisions by the U.S. Supreme Court that has, in the past, eroded public faith and has created that constitutional crisis that you're talking about. And, Doc, I hate it. Unfortunately, we're out of time. But it's topics like this, like the Constitution, the Supreme Court of the United States, Bill of Rights, that I can't wait to hear more about when we get to meet in the future and talk about all this stuff. I just can't wait to pick your brain on.
Well, I look forward to it.
Okay, thanks, Dr. Darren Sampson from Pitt State University. I'm Kevin Seidenstricker on Four States Live. We're going to take a break, and we'll be right back.